are listening to the most original talk radio station anywhere. We are LA Talk Radio at latalkradio.com.
You're listening to History and You with George Rodriguez Walling right here on LA Talk Radio.
And good evening to everyone, and welcome to History and You. Welcome to the show. The show where history matters, because you decide what history becomes. I'm your host, George Rodriguez Walling, and I'm very happy to be here with you this evening. If you want to call in and contribute your thoughts and insights, please call 323-203-0815. That's 323-203-0815. Call in and tell me your thoughts. Tell me your views on the issue tonight. If not, send me an email, please, at historyandyou@yahoo.com. That's historyandyou@yahoo.com. You'll find me in latalkradio.com. Look for History and You. Also, please visit my and support my Facebook and Twitter links on the website as a follow-up to each and every program. Okay, tonight's topic, on being married. That's right, on being married. So, let me ask you something. What condition is your marriage in? Yeah, what condition is it in? How is your marriage really doing? Is it a bit flat? Have you taken each other for granted enough times already? Are you married for, say, companionship? Financial interest? Are you already so dependent on each other that there is no room for anything else? The institution of marriage is dying. Do we really care? This is a question that preoccupies an awful lot of people, and an awful lot of people just don't want to face it. You know, we get married because we love the ones we marry, supposedly. Marriage allows us to have and to share an intimacy unlike any other. It lets us see the world in much the same way. And because eventually throughout our married lives, marriage will allow us to become partners in all things, supposedly. But when we say we love the one we marry, what do we really mean? Well, it's supposed to mean that nothing else matters in the world except that person. That you live for that person in body and soul, and that you first think of that person with a gladness in your heart to make the other person happy before you think of yourself. This state of mind presupposes, even requires, a kind of maturity that many of us just don't have. It requires an insight and a wholeness that some people are afraid to ever strive for. Loving someone in marriage is a willingness to be vulnerable. Loving someone out of wedlock is a manageable risk. So, if the context of your relationship determines the quality of your love, then expect the meaning of love in your life to be something different. Something you've not come to know very well. There are many who will not go beyond a traditional marriage, but they also won't want to work at it either. But there are differences in our tolerance level to managing a marriage. These differences between people many times can vary widely, but can also bear down on a marriage, as many have come to know very quickly and only too well. So let's move away from the Cinderella image of marriage for a moment. Let's separate ourselves for a minute or two from the glitzy and romantic overlay that only smothers another very important perspective on marriage. And that is that marriage in all that it brings and all that it comes to represent is a hell of a lot of work. It really, really is. It's a lot of work. And please, please don't bother telling me that marriage isn't work if you're really in love with each other. That's one of the dumbest things I could ever hear. Be real. Look at your life and see what you got to do. It's an up at dawn, 24/7, get up every day and be prepared to share every pain, every joy, every triumph, setback, illness, promotion, money, moods, sex, infidelity, inequalities between you, arguments, envy, jealousies, fights, inadequacies, in-laws, kids, struggles, boredom. In short, get ready to do life together and grow old together to face every pitch that life is going to throw at you. You'd best be ready for it. If not, life and marriage both will knock you on your ass over and over again. Yeah. You know, I've often wondered about the history of marriage. Is it an institutional invention? Where the hell did it come from, anyways? Is it man-made? Is it like a bunch of people just sitting around and decided to all of a sudden invent marriage? Where did it come from? Has it become such a convention where all of us have come to take for granted that being married is the only way to live proper? Why can't we just live together? Hire a cook to make dinners and a maid to do laundry. And if you want some nightly comfort, call a friend and share a sheet together. It'd be easy, wouldn't it? Without confusing love and laundry or dinners and cooks, living together without a marriage license seems to liberate us from feeling so confined and so pressed with another person. But you know, it's precisely this kind of commitment that can make us feel better about ourselves. When in a marriage, we give up so much for someone else, there's a lot to fear. But it's through this fear that we can then decide to trust someone else to pull us out. And that's the connection that begins to make us feel happier with each other. It's something that happens naturally. With love, as in marriage, nothing, and I mean nothing, is ever forced. To commit to someone else is a conscious choice to be dedicated. And to see that challenge of that dedication through. So the question is, do you have what it takes, not so much in getting married, but to stay married for the rest of your life? There's a majority of people today who cannot do that, who will not do that. And so they're looking for happiness in all the wrong ways and in all the bad places without realizing that the happiness they look for is sometimes standing very close by, watching and waiting for the time to be right for you to meet that chance at being happy again. The history of marriage is long because people have constantly looked for different ways to finding security of love they seek within an illusion of what people might come to consider a good or unique marriage. There's no illusion about it. Realistically, you have to get out of your comfort zone and make it work. And be glad about making it work, too. If you do, I promise you, you'll start feeling happy about the efforts you make at keeping your marriage healthy. Let me take a quick pause here to remind our audience, for the participants who wish to call in with questions or comments, the number is 323-203-0815. That's 323-203-0815. Or please just send me an email at historyandyou@yahoo.com. That's historyandyou@yahoo.com. I would really love to hear from you. You know, throughout history, marriage hasn't always been a fair arrangement, particularly for women. The most of Western history, marriage was not a mere personal matter concerning only husband and wife, but rather the business of their two families, which brought them together. Most marriages, therefore, were, as we have come to know, arranged. Moreover, the wife usually had much fewer rights than her husband, and was expected to be subservient to him. To a considerable extent, marriage was also an economic arrangement. In a lot of respects, there was little room for romantic love, and even simple affection was not considered essential. Procreation and cooperation were the main marital duties. On the other hand, it may surprise a lot of people to learn that in earlier times, divorce was often easily granted. Here again, men usually had the advantage when they could simply dismiss their wives, but in many instances, women could also sue for divorce. In ancient Rome, couples could even divorce each other by mutual agreement. There are universal stresses, though, on the necessity of marriage, on the need to get married, and the resulting pressure on single people to get married was astronomical. This pressure was partially lifted only under the influence of Christianity, which at least for some time found special virtue in celibacy, of all things. Good heavens, celibacy. It's not even a natural thing. But be that as it may, in ancient Greece, marriage was seen as a fundamental social institution. In Athens, under Pericles, bachelors were excluded from certain important public positions, even with that. Sparta, while encouraging sexual relations between men, nevertheless insisted on their marrying and producing children. Single and childless men were treated with incredible, shall we say, scorn, disapproval. However, while marriages were deemed important, it was usually treated as a practical matter without much romantic significance. A father arranged most advantageous marriage for his son and then had a contract signed before witnesses. Shortly thereafter, a wedding celebration was held, and the young couple, whom I never have even met before, was escorted to bed, of all things. All marriages were monogamous. As a rule, the bridegroom was in his 30s and the bride was a teenager. In addition to this disparity in ages, there was also existed an inequality in education and political rights. Women were considered inferior to men and remain confined to the home. Their main functions, as we've come to know in many cultures and many time periods, their function as wives was to produce children and to manage the household, while their husbands tended to public affairs. For their erotic needs, men often turned to prostitutes or concubines. It was always easier for a husband to divorce, and men normally asked for a divorce only in cases of female adultery or infertility. Interestingly, in early Roman history, a husband had considerable power over his wife and children. whom he could punish, he could sell. Hell, he can even kill him, believe it or not, as he saw. He can do as he saw fit with his family, in short. However, eventually women came to enjoy a better legal position and gained more and more control over their lives and property. Thus, in imperial times, husband and wife approached marriage as equals. And while the Romans tolerated prostitution and concubines and had no qualms about homosexual relationships, their marriage laws were remarkably fair, or came to be that, and thus greatly contributed to their emancipation. Marriages in ancient Israel was also an interesting twist. From the Bible, the ancient Israelites had a patriarchal family structure. The status of women was low, and they were regarded as the property of their fathers or husbands and could do nothing without their consent. The main purpose of marriage was procreation and the promotion of the man's name. Every healthy person was expected to marry. Single men and women were despised. A man could have several wives and several concubines. Jacob, for example, married two sisters, Leah and Rachel. And Solomon was known to have 700 wives and 300 concubines. Divorce was not encouraged, but permitted if a man found some uncleanliness in his wife. In such a case, he simply wrote her a bill of divorce and sent her out of his house, found in Deuteronomy 24:1. However, it was virtually impossible for a wife to divorce her husband. The Bible indicates that the marriage laws and customs of Israel changed somewhat in the course of time. Thus, divorces were increasingly frowned upon, and there was a general trend toward monogamy. Another change concerned the so-called levirate, in other words, a man's obligatory marriage to his brother's widow. This kind of marriage was at times required, found in Deuteronomy 25:5, and other times prohibited, found in Leviticus 20:21. This change was probably related to changing economic conditions. And it was usually the patriarch who selected the bride for his son and who paid what became known as a bride price. The acceptance of this bride price constituted a legal binding betrothal, which was followed by some wedding celebration when the bride took up residence with her new family. Both male and females married in their early teens, shortly after puberty. Theoretically, therefore, neither sex was subjected to any lengthy period of sexual frustration and not being able to do anything, obviously. Still, because of an unquestioned sexual double standard, men had a far greater opportunity for sexual fulfillment than women. In medieval Europe, things became also somewhat interesting. The first Christian emperors were more or less content with their tradition of Roman law, and they followed it up to a certain time period. They also repealed older laws, which had penalized the unmarried and the childless, since the new Christian ascetic way of living favored virginity and sexual abstinence over marriage. The newly Christianized countries of Northern Europe had a rather barbaric marriage customs and treated women little better than domestic slaves in Germanic law. Marriage was essentially a business deal between the bridegroom and the bride's father. It was a sale marriage. The symbol of a successful bride sale was the ring. It was a form of down payment which was given to the bride herself. Acceptance of the ring constituted the betrothal. The church soon refined these primitive customs. According to Roman law and Christian belief, marriage could be built only on the free consent of both partners, which now begins to modernize the idea a bit. And this doctrine was bound to raise the status of women. Furthermore, theologians increasingly found a religious significance in marriage and even eventually included sacraments, including marriage as a sacrament. And this is somewhat important and revealing because it goes back to the earlier question of, is marriage a man-made invention? Is marriage something that was concocted suddenly? Well, it seems to be somewhat of a pattern of development where theologians as well as civilizations and cultures simply added piece by piece by piece. But problems ultimately emerged. It abolished divorce by declaring marriage to be insoluble, except by death, and generally increased the number of marriage prohibitions. Consanguinity, which means relationship by blood, along with affinity and spiritual affinity, became somewhat problematic. This meant that nobody could marry anyone more closely related than a third cousin. According to consanguinity laws, or relationship by law, by blood. Affinity now referred to a mysterious closeness between the two families of husband and wife, and spiritual affinity was said to exist between godparents and godchildren. This closeness between the godparents and the godchildren with their families. The influence of the church on marriage became gradually stronger and stronger. Now, I've often wondered what might be the future of marriage. Well, there are various forms of marriages out there, which I'd like to talk to you about and consider the possibility of where the institution of marriage is heading. Because the traditional monogamous type is clearly, gradually, I should really say, being phased out. Why? A lot of people are finding themselves to be more and more discontent, more and more disillusioned, more and more confined. I personally think it's because they haven't made the right choices. They haven't worked at their marriage because they love who they're married to, and they haven't worked toward that goal. But regardless of, notwithstanding that issue, that part of it, people are constantly looking for fulfillment in other forms of marriage. Let's discuss the other forms that are out there. The future of marriage lies in various types. The first one I want to talk to you about is called open marriage. In such a marriage, both partners love and cherish each other and do want to live together. They want to live together, but they also permit each other to have other sexual encounters. In fact, they may occasionally admit a third or fourth partner to their marital bed. Wow. Such arrangements are nothing new. They're really not. They have existed throughout history among many peoples. For example, among certain American Indians and Eskimos, it was customary for husbands to offer their wives to their male guests. Many Polynesian men also followed this practice and, in addition, granted their own brothers the same privilege. They themselves, in turn, had sexual access to their sister-in-laws. Holy cow! In Hawaii, such a relationship was known as punalua. But even apart from these socially approved forms of open marriage, quote-unquote, extramarital sex has been silently condoned in many other societies, especially for males. Females were usually more restricted. Although in the 18th century Europe, upper class husbands often allowed their wives an official lover. In one form or another, these old customs may well survive into the future. The other type of marriage, temporary marriage. Islamic countries, as well as in Japan, these kinds of marriages are found. Temporary marriages. Today, it is no longer unusual for either men or women to marry and divorce 2, 3, or 4 partners within a few years. In view of these developments, it has been suggested that the law should officially set a predetermined date for the end of each marriage. At this date, the marriage could, of course, be renewed for another agreed upon period, but without such a renewal, it would automatically be dissolved. Thus, divorce would become unnecessary. However, the critics of this proposal point out that fixed time limits of any kind can cast a disturbing cloud over a marriage. The third kind of marriage that we're looking at here, trial marriage. Oh, the trial marriage is bizarre. Throughout most of European history, farmers within the rural area, sometimes things get awfully lonely out there, but putting all humor aside, farmers have allowed their children premarital sexual experiences in order to ensure a compatible match and to test the fecundity, in other words, the fertility of a woman, in this case, of any prospective bride. Well, at least this is one way to try and make sure that people make the right choices as to whom they want to spend the rest of their lives with. You want to try them out first and see how things work out? It's sort of like living together. According to this custom, a girl could conceive, or excuse me, could receive a man in her bed at night if her parents regarded him as a serious prospect. So a girl could welcome a young man into her bed to try him out. At first, these nightly visits might not necessarily involve any physical intimacy. I would assume they engage in some degree of conversation to sort of like getting to know you type of thing. But if they become more frequent, that is, these visits, well, then things become even more intimate without necessarily elaborating into the details. However, marriage was always the ultimate goal here, especially if the girl became pregnant and both partners remained well aware of their mutual obligations. All of these customs served the rural populace well for a lot of centuries, as you might imagine, until they died out under the influx of an awful lot of strangers who started to take advantage. Today, many young couples already practice some of this trial marriage type of arrangement by simply, as I mentioned a moment ago, living together. For some time, they got married. Such private informal agreements are likely to continue and may also become more frequent in the future. The other kind of marriage, a very controversial one, polygamy. And polygamy is, of course, involving the privilege, I guess, of having more than one spouse. So this kind of arrangement, polygamy, in both in its variations, polygyny and polyandry, the woman having or the man having multiple wives, the woman having multiple husbands, has a long and venerable history, a very genuine one. Polygamy is condoned in both the Old Testament and the Quran. However, under the influence of Christianity, and as a result of growing demands for sexual equality, this form of marriage has long since disappeared in Western civilization and is under attack in other parts of the world. In 19th century America, the Mormons reintroduced it, but were soon forced to abandon it, at least officially. Nevertheless, polygamy has retained its appeal for some people. It has also repeatedly been pointed out that for many Westerners now have begun to practice some of this serial polygamy by marrying and divorcing several partners in the course of their lives. Thus, it's not inconceivable that in the future, some men would again take several wives and some wives would take several husbands if they were legally entitled to do so. Even today, a number of people are convicted of bigamy every year, and others who escape prosecution live in a so-called ménage à trois with one official and one unofficial spouse. Someday, such arrangements might well be officially recognized. Needless to say, every partner in such a marriage would have to be given the same legal rights. The other interesting kind of marriage that is going around and possibly another prospect for the future is group marriage. In a group marriage, several husbands are married to several wives. Or in other words, all men are married to all women in the group. Such marriages have never been common anywhere, although a few examples have been found among some primitive peoples. John Humphrey Noyes and his Oneida community, for example, was one. In certain contemporary communes, group marriages has existed and still exists, although in many cases the emotional strain on the partners proved to be too great, and more traditional marriage patterns reasserted themselves. Nevertheless, in the future, some attempts at group marriage may continue, and occasionally they may even succeed. Whether they will or should be legally recognized is an entirely different question. The next marriage that could also take root and grow as more and more of a future set marriage is same-sex marriage or gay marriages. It always provokes serious discussion, not only because of the idea of a same-gender marriage, but also when it comes to kids and the adoption of kids and how are you going to rear them up. However, until now, our Western civilization has never permitted marriage between partners of the same sex. A few other civilizations have become more broad-minded. Thus, in some American Indian tribes, it was possible for a man to assume the role of a woman and to marry another man. Among the Siwans of Northern Africa, many men married male adolescents and even paid a higher bride price for them than for girls. Still, generally speaking, such customs have always been rare because marriage was usually associated with procreation. Therefore, even where homosexual relationships were encouraged, they remained pre- or extramarital. Many homosexuals, of course, have no desire to be married, as incredible as that may seem. But there are also many others who live in stable and sometimes even lifelong relationships, and who suffer disadvantages because these relationships cannot be legalized as marriages. Tax inheritance, immigration laws, just to name a few, discriminate them. And thus, they do not find themselves rewarded for their responsible behavior. Indeed, one may say that today our society is still conspiring to keep homosexuals unstable and promiscuous. However, these are now several Christian churches, especially the Metropolitan Community Church, perform weddings, or shall we call them holy unions, ceremonies for homosexual couples. Such ceremonies does not constitute a legal marriage, but at least it gives some recognition to couples who want to make a firm commitment to each other. However, in the meantime, some important changes have taken place in a lot of countries. Several European and non-European countries have officially recognized same-sex marriages with all the privileges and all the duties of traditional heterosexual marriages. Such countries are the Netherlands, Belgium, Spain, Norway, Sweden, Iceland, and Portugal. A footnote for Portugal, however, the adoption of children by same-sex couples still remains prohibited. Outside of Europe, same-sex marriages are being recognized in Canada, Argentina, South Africa, and several states within our country, the United States, such as New York, Connecticut, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, Vermont, and the District of Columbia. In general, the situation is changeable, and in fact, changing since other countries are discussing or preparing the legal recognition of same-sex marriages as well. Well, good for them. To commit to someone else is a conscious choice to be dedicated. And to see that challenge of that dedication through. So the question becomes, do you have what it takes, not so much in getting married, but to stay married for the rest of your life? No matter what it is, a new, unconventional, alternative forms of marriage or traditional kinds, the idea of commitment seems to be waning, seems to be fading. There's a majority of people today who cannot do that. And so they're looking for happiness in all the wrong ways and in all the bad places without realizing that happiness is waiting for them. You know, marriage is not a deep, dark secret. It's simply a willingness to make it work because supposedly you love the person you're with. And because you want to share with that person more things than you ever considered before, that's when working a marriage won't feel like work at all. Marriage is something you really gotta want. Not real bad, but very seriously. And there's a difference. When you want something real bad, it may result in a whim or simply a flavor of the moment. But wanting something seriously means taking a realistic view about how you feel toward the other person and asking yourself, could this work? And are my feelings for him or her stronger than my unwillingness to sacrifice everything for that person? Are my feelings stronger for him or her than my unwillingness to sacrifice everything for that other person? That's a very tough question to think about, and one that many people don't want to face when considering the present state of your marriage. This question then leads to love. What is it, and how do you come to know it? I can't tell you what it is. Perhaps love was never meant to be known, but only felt. I can try to describe the way to it, but that's all. But once you come to feel it, you'll know it. You'll always remember it. And the memory of that feeling will never leave you. It'll change you as a person from what you were to what you are becoming for a lifetime. The problem that worries me, though, the most, I would say, in the whole discussion of marriage, is the part about choosing a spouse. And this brings me to young people, once again, who are very preoccupied with falling in what they call love. This worries me considerably, because it's in this stage of choosing that young people are the most stubborn in taking advice, that they will very likely act out or model or replicate what they see and what they hear at home, and that they are deeply influenced and deeply affected by what they learn is love in a marriage from home. And if that home is broken, the assimilation of these values will also find themselves broken, and many times irreparably. Young folks looking for the truth about love and marriage use what they see at home and make their choices based on the examples their parents give them. Primarily, this is the central risk, because it can lead to happy marriages or nasty divorces and separations that only serve to divide the family further. Whether marriages are monogamous or alternative forms, the warmth that comes from a loving marriage will affect and even determine the kinds of families your own kids will also have down the road. A more daring question is whether traditional monogamous marriages make for a happier family and home life than alternative forms do. I don't know. I really don't. Psychologically, do the nature of kids require them to be exposed to the natural roles of a mother and a father figure? I think they do. And this is not to put down alternative forms of marriage, because they too have their usefulness in offering a different kind of affection and companionship to those kinds of people who have found it difficult to adjust to a more traditional style of marriage. And so, I'm not suggesting either that kids brought up by a gay couple, for example, can't get a loving home life. I'm very sure they can. As a matter of fact, I'm willing to bet those kids will be more likely to be happier at a younger age than those from traditional marriages. Why? Very simple. Knowing how hard and how hostile the world is toward alternative marriages, those gay parents will probably work twice as hard at making their marriage and their home life the happiest possible for their adopted kids. If only traditional marriages would also work as hard for their kids. Maybe traditional marriages have taken for granted the world's acceptance of their lifestyle too much, and as a consequence, have been remiss or negligent to themselves and to their own kids. But yes, I do think that kids need a mother and a father figure. Because therein lies a very delicate psychological balance that young adolescents need to absorb from both genders as a measure of growing and as a measure of understanding who and what they are. And all within a sense of rationality, all within a sense of balance, all within a sense of psychological stability. Good, vigilant, and caring parents can facilitate enormously the process of making kids understand and assimilate their gender roles along the way. But when a marriage is fractured and the gender balance is broken, the chances of kids surviving that tear becomes much more difficult. And while we also know that gay kids can emerge from traditional marriages, as well, one can still have a reason to pause and wonder if one of those spouses in a broken marriage would have chosen better the first time around, if one of them would have been perhaps more careful in their choosing, would it have made a better difference for the kids? So, you know, it all goes back to making a marriage work. Which means what? To choose right. To choose right. To make the right choices. To make an effort when you normally can't or wouldn't want to. To sacrifice. To please your spouse. To tell them something nice once in a while. And mean it. To apologize when you've hurt them. To make amends quickly. To never be proud of yourself, but of your spouse, always. To treat them with the respect and the dignity they deserve. To never strike, but stroke. To be faithful in mind and heart. To help clean up the kitchen when dinner is made. To show gratitude for special favors. To compliment them when they dress up for you. To never tell them they look fat. And last, to never have a reason for giving a kiss. You know, I used to write articles as a freelancer for web companies that would host such opportunities. And one day I chose to write a short satirical article about marriage and my wife. The piece is entitled, The Day I Became a Schmuck, and it reads like this. The day I became a schmuck was the day I said, I do. Marriage is a curious institution and not for the faint of heart. It verified my delusions of being a man and clarified what I still do as a girly man. It's a transformation of what I once believed reality to be, especially when watching your own wife go into a metamorphosis before your very eyes when struggling with menstrual cycles, pregnancies, postpartum depressions, and of course, the ultimate joy and granddaddy of them all, menopause. The bliss of marriage becomes the kiss of death if you're determined to think that you're the boss in that relationship. Let me tell you, you're not. You're the boss of nothing except the sound of your own breathing. And with all the mood swings, frightening whims, and erratic pangs that so often play upon a woman, I've often wondered, what happened to her? What happened to that sweet and sexy, soft-spoken woman with gentle manners and alluring looks that made me fall in lust and dream dirty? What happens to a woman when she hears her man say, I do? Well, with me, I've lost my sense of self. That's right. I'm no longer the man I used to be in the family room, in the kitchen, and in the bedroom. Let's start with the family room. A man's home is a special sanctuary, or so I thought, impervious to all influences in the world, a castle of sorts. Yeah, that's it, a fortress. of will and strength that embodies and personifies the one, the only predominant figure there, the man of the house. But when I started noticing that I no longer had TV rights, only privileges, and that I could no longer eat at my pleasure, that I couldn't put my feet up and relax as often, and that I wasn't allowed to bring friends to the house for fun like before, I couldn't figure out how I was gradually losing control of my home and still think I had all this power. It was like winning the battles in a war, but gradually be losing that war. Only a schmuck. Only a schmuck. In the kitchen, my wife cooks like a gourmet chef. So I'd often wander in before dinner and pick on some bites here and there, little pieces, now and again. Oh my God, the slaps and screams I'd get. Well, enough to say the look I'd get was that from a demonic wild woman, ready to strike at a moment's notice. Other times I felt more courageous. So I would pass by the kitchen following a wonderfully alluring scent of something spectacularly delicious, but I wouldn't dare to go in there anymore. Hell, it became a death wish. And besides, I would have had cactus for dinner that night if I even dared. But after all, I did say I do, didn't I? And in the bedroom, the famous boudoir. Well, here's where the adventure really begins, and also ended just as quickly in confirming my illusions of manhood. Aside from her usual excuses of headaches, tiredness, and feeling a bit under the weather, which happens quite often, this is the venue where a man's virility counts the most. It's the do-or-die moment of what we as men live for. It's the ultimate packing house for leaving your name inscribed and etched in her memory of you for a lifetime. This is it. Make it count. So I'd go in there with a belly full of beans and vinegar to let her know who's boss. Right. And in no time, I was reduced to a weenie moment and a peewee performance to boot. What a putz. But there I was, embarrassed and confused. And just as quickly I was sent off with a cute little smile, a peck for a kiss, and love you. Good night. Looking at the ceiling, hands folded in this dark and now quiet room, I couldn't believe what just happened. I saw my testosterone go up in a puff of smoke. I said this couldn't be happening to me. So after a while, I got enough huff and puff in me to get bold and frisky once again and decided to wake her up. Oh, Jesus, I nearly wet myself when this woman turned on the light, turned over to me with fixed eyes and stared out a homicidal look with veins in her eyes that ran like red rivers of blood, and said with a voice that sounded like it came out of a tomb, "Don't even think about it." I froze. I got wet, too. And with all the delicate times of the month, the pregnancies, the mood swings, and all the rest of it, the one condition that stands out the most in my mind is menopause. After all, it's such a warm and reassuring feeling to know you're being yelled at for asking a question, to wake up every morning looking like a popsicle, to be kissed one moment and thrashed the next, to have your sex life be tossed and skewered like a red onion, and to converse with your wife as if you're fencing for points. Ah, yes. These are the finer moments of a changing wife. Menopause, in all that it represents, is like living with a bowling alley in your brain, never knowing whether you have a line of bowlers waiting to knock you on your ass. And with every new day, you can be pretty sure that new surprises are going to be waiting for you. But you know, with all the inconveniences that life brings on a woman, I wouldn't trade a day of it if it meant being without her. This schmuck said, "I do," for all the right reasons. She is my soulmate for life. She's my laughter, my daily dose of happiness. She is why my day feels right, because it's her that helps me become a more complete man in all things. And because it is my wish to always see her happy with all of my heart, I chose to belong to her. And why? It's easy. I love my wife. I do. Sincerely, married. Some final thoughts, and then I will leave you with this. Being married is an adventure without end. It used to be that getting married and starting a family was the most exciting thing in your life. It was the ultimate ride to take. But today, the sign of our time is approach with caution. Marriage is perceived as a conditional experience, where one is never trapped into anything or anyone, where alternative forms of marriage, as divorces from traditional ones, are quickly becoming the order of the day, and where young people who still fall in love are trying to decide what to do with their love. The success of a marriage first starts with the model that parents provide, and the consistency and stability of that model will determine for their children the values to look for in other people from making the right choices and learning the work ethic necessary to make a marriage work and last. Today, people don't care as much because marriages, as with home life, are fractured institutions, which are, by and large, dysfunctional in providing vital roles to guide young people with future decisions. Some would argue that there are too many choices out there and too many liberties that only serve to enable the young and the old as well to embark on commitments without thinking them through more carefully. Are they wrong? Is the opinion too conservative? Well, look around you. What do you see? What are the signs of our times telling us? As for me, well, I have a wife. I talk about her. I write about her. I even sing to her on occasion. I do all I can for her because I love her. More than anything else in this world, she is, as I've already said, my soulmate. And when coming home from what remains of the day, my best moment is to see her happy and listen to her laugh. Just to see her is enough for me. And so it is with all my heart that I can say I am a happily married spouse. Are you? Catch me again next Tuesday nights. Don't forget, as your host for this evening's show, this is George Rodriguez Walling, wishing all of you a very pleasant evening. Good night.
You're listening to History and You with George Rodriguez Walling, right here on LA Talk Radio.